behind the scenes, the things you don't see.
After 20 terms in Congress, Nancy Pelosi says she's out, that she won't seek re-election.
We'll ask a biographer of the Speaker Emeritus about her legacy this Thursday, November 6th on All Things Considered.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Ahead this hour, the Trump administration says SNAP benefit cuts this month won't be quite as deep as had been expected.
We have hundreds of thousands of children who are fed every day because their families have SNAP benefits. I don't even know where to start with how crazy this is.
And the new movie Christy is based on the true story of Christy Martin.
Back in the 90s, she was the most successful female boxer and the first woman signed by Don King.
My style was definitely seek and destroy. Knocking somebody out and trash talking. It was fun.
Those stories and more after today's news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. A federal judge is ordering the Trump administration to fully fund SNAP food benefits during the government shutdown. The ruling comes after the administration said it would only partially fund food aid, after initially saying it wouldn't at all. Last week, two judges ordered the government to pay for the benefits using an emergency fund. This is day 37 of the record-long government shutdown. Earlier this week, some Democrats suggested they were searching for a way out, but as NPR's Sam Greenglass reports, victories at the ballot box Tuesday have emboldened many of them to hold firm.
Over breakfast at the White House, President Trump told Senate Republicans the shutdown hurt their party on election night. The results have given some Democrats, like Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, confidence to hold out for an extension of expiring health care subsidies.
The election results were not vague. They were a lightning bolt.
Bipartisan talks among rank-and-file senators are continuing, but it's unclear if eight Democrats will back a funding measure without a firm plan to extend the subsidies that can also pass the House and get the president's signature. Sam Greenglass, NPR News, Washington.
The government shutdown is threatening to disrupt air travel nationwide. With fewer staff on duty, the FAA is warning of delays and limited airspace starting tomorrow. NPR's Windsor Johnston has more on what travelers can do to avoid getting grounded.
The Federal Aviation Administration is urging passengers to plan for longer security and boarding times. Some regional control centers could operate with reduced staff, meaning fewer flights allow through at once. Airlines are advising customers to check flight status early and sign up for text alerts. The Transportation Security Administration says arriving at least 2 hours before domestic flights and three for international is even more critical during the shutdown. Travel experts recommend booking early morning departures. The FAA says it's working to minimize disruptions, but until funding is restored, even clear skies could mean crowded airspace. Windsor Johnston, NPR News, Washington.
Former Speaker of the House and California Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi says she won't seek re-election, NPR's Barbara Sprunt reports.
First elected in 1987, Pelosi would go on to become one of the most effective leaders of the Democratic Party. She cemented her place in the history books in 2007 when she was elected to become the first woman to serve as Speaker of the House. She could reliably deliver Democratic votes on must-pass legislation when necessary, although her first speakership came at a complicated time with a looming financial crisis. She reclaimed the gavel in 2019. During her 10 years as speaker, she oversaw the passage of landmark legislation, including the Affordable Care Act, and enacted trillions in new spending as part of the American Rescue Plan. Barbara Sprunt, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. The Senate is voting on legislation to check President Trump's ability to launch an attack against Venezuela. Lawmakers, including top Republicans, have demanded the Trump administration provide them with more information on the military strikes against alleged drug smuggling vessels in the Caribbean and Eastern Pacific Ocean. The UN Security Council has removed sanctions on Syria's new leader. This comes just days before President Ahmad al-Shara is due to meet President Trump at the White House, as NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
The U.S. drafted the resolution, which passed 14-0. China abstained, saying the U.S. did not take into account its concerns about terrorist groups in Syria. Al-Shara led insurgents who toppled Syrian President Bashar al-Assad last year. U.S. Ambassador Mike Waltz says now that al-Shara and Syria's interior minister have been taken off the U.N. sanctions list, they can help give Syria a chance for greatness.
With the adoption of this text, the Council is sending a strong political signal that recognizes Syria is in a new era.
He says al-Shara is working hard to counter terrorism and promote regional stability. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
Solar storms may bring colorful auroras to several northern U.S. states tonight. The sun emitted a huge burst of energy that's currently on its way to Earth. Once it gets here, it could cause colorful light displays. Authorities say they don't expect major disruptions to radio communications. The sun's at its maximum phase of its 11-year activity cycle. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Sony Pictures Classics with Nuremberg, a new thriller starring Russell Crowe, Rami Malek, and Michael Shannon about the historic post-World War II trial of Nazi official Hermann Göring. Starts Friday in theaters.
It is 4:06, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Support for KAXE comes from Atchison Tire in Grand Rapids, providing service and offering tire brands like Bridgestone, Firestone, and Toyo, serving the area since 1916, or at atchisontire.com. Weather tonight, cloudy skies with a slight chance of rain, lows 29 to 35 degrees, southeast winds 5 to 15 miles per hour. Now back to All Things Considered.
Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. One of the most powerful women in the history of American politics says she will not seek re-election.
With a grateful heart, I look forward to my final year of service as your proud representative. As we go forward,
Nancy Pelosi made the announcement today in a video dedicated to her San Francisco constituents. Pelosi was first elected to Congress nearly four decades ago in 1987, and the freshman Democrat immediately established herself as a bold voice in the House chamber. Here's Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief of USA Today and author of Madam Speaker, Nancy Pelosi and the Lessons of Power.
She was fearless from the start. You know, that was a time when AIDS was a very serious issue in San Francisco, but it was one that there was a big stigma about. And so a lot of politicians didn't want to talk about HIV/AIDS. Nancy Pelosi started talking about the importance of addressing AIDS and addressing those, helping those who were struggling with AIDS from her first speech on the House floor. And that was really a sign for things to come. She was someone who was not afraid to talk about big issues in ways that sometimes made other people uncomfortable or angry.
She made history as the first woman to become Speaker of the House in 2007. I remember that well. How big a deal was it? And how big of a deal is it still, almost two decades later? She's been the only one.
Yeah, look at all the women who've been Speaker of the House. There's one. Our President of the United States.
Uh-huh.
Our Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. You know, she is the only woman to head one of our three co-equal branches of government. And that tells you something about how significant that election was.
I mean, the fact that she was a high-profile woman leading Democrats in the House made her both the subject of sexist attacks at times, but she was also something of a feminist hero, a subject of adoration. How did Nancy Pelosi herself reckon with all of that public discourse that seemed to swirl around her?
She ignored it. She plowed on. She pretended she dismissed sexist attacks by and large. She just went and did her job. She was enormously focused on just getting things done. But she turned around and helped a whole generation of women after her, including, by the way, the two women who were elected governor of New Jersey and Virginia on Tuesday.
You're both talking of them there about Mikey Sherrill and Abigail Spanberger.
Exactly. Both former House members who Nancy Pelosi helped gain their political footing.
I was a congressional reporter at times when Nancy Pelosi was leading House Democrats, and I remember watching her sort of wield her power well. Susan Page, can you talk a little bit about her political legacy in Congress? She was this prominent force pushing the Obama White House to deliver on the Affordable Care Act. What did that moment show us about who she was as a political leader?
Well, remember that the Affordable Care Act had been a promise of Barack Obama's during the campaign. But when the time came to deliver, there were those in the White House who wanted to do a kind of a small version of it. Nancy Pelosi did not allow that to happen. And while the Affordable Care Act certainly wouldn't have passed without President Obama, it also would not have passed without Nancy Pelosi. And even among Democrats, there were those who thought it would be an impossible task to get that big transformative legislation through Congress, and it is the achievement that she says she is most proud of.
In a different era of our politics, bipartisanship was a celebrated virtue both on the left and the right. How much did bipartisanship matter to Pelosi throughout her political career? And I wonder, Susan, did her views on that change?
Nancy Pelosi was a pretty fierce partisan from the start. She was a Democrat. There were no question about her allegiances. That said, she delivered for a Republican president, for George W. Bush in 2008, the financial meltdown, that bank bailout was failing to get through. Republicans were not passing the bank bailout that the president needed, that economists said was important to avoid another great recession. And it was Nancy Pelosi who finally pushed that through Congress at some considerable political cost. She thought it was a big factor in Democrats then losing control to the House and her losing the speakership. That was a gesture of bipartisanship on her part because she felt it was crucial for the future of the country and even the globe.
We should also note that Nancy Pelosi exerted a really powerful influence on the presidency. Back in 2008, she pushed back on a plan for superdelegates to help Hillary Clinton take the Democratic nomination from Barack Obama, which then helped Obama, of course, secure his path to the White House. And in 2024, just last year, she was key in getting Biden to drop out of the presidential race. What do those moves say about her power within the Democratic Party more broadly outside of Capitol Hill?
You know, it's mostly behind the scenes. She's not great at giving a speech. She's not a charismatic figure. And when Joe Biden was continuing to seek a second term last year, and a lot of Democrats thought that was a bad idea, it was Nancy Pelosi who stepped up to really engineer the pressure on him that got him to drop that race.
As you look back now, we are in a moment where Republicans hold the presidency as well as both houses of Congress. What do you see as Nancy Pelosi's political legacy?
You know, I think the thing she has some regret about is that she's leaving office while Donald Trump is still in it. She was actually thinking seriously about retiring from Congress in 2016. And didn't because Donald Trump got elected. She thought she'd leave the announcement she made today. She was going to make that after Hillary Clinton had been elected president. And when that didn't happen, she signed back on because of her opposition to Trump and her belief that he represented a threat to democratic institutions.
Susan Page is the author of Madam Speaker, Nancy Pelosi and the Lessons of Power. Susan, thank you.
I want to thank you.
It's Thursday, and that means another drop of NPR's National Security Podcast. On this week's Sources and Methods, how extreme views on the far right are dividing Americans. Now, that is clearly a political story, but what does it have to do with national security? I put that to NPR domestic extremism correspondent Odette Youssef.
You know, 9/11 was a physical assault on U.S. soil by a foreign enemy. And I think that that is sort of traditionally how we've thought about the question of national security. And so now, fast forward to January 6th, when we look at what happened that day, sort of the attempt to forcefully prevent the results of a democratic election from going forward, that was a threat from within. So national security does include sort of this concern about domestic extremism. The way that I think about it is that these strands of an authoritarian movement that we're seeing on the right really are about taking apart the very principles of inclusive democracy that distinguished America from its enemies on 9/11.
Now, Odette and I were talking about this because of a controversy that's splitting the Republican Party, specifically conservative talk show host Tucker Carlson's interview with Nick Fuentes. Fuentes has praised Hitler, defended Jim Crow, and called for a holy war against Jews. A think tank closely aligned with the Trump administration initially defended the interview. This was not a hard-hitting interview. This was a friendly chat.
It was. I mean, you can find many of Nick Fuentes' statements online. I mean, he's online all the time. You know, at one point in the interview, he talks about his love for Stalin.
Stalin, who, just for the record, the Soviet leader who killed millions of his own people. Go on.
That's right. So, yeah, it was an odd sort of treatment of the opportunity to really query Nick Fuentes, I would say.
Although, why did this interview in particular trigger such a big fight within the GOP that we're sitting here talking about it as a national security story? Because Tucker Carlson has had, I'm trying to remember, a Holocaust conspiracist on his show before. He has promoted the racist theory, the Great Replacement conspiracy theory.
So the Fuhrer seems really to be centering on the Heritage Foundation, a conservative think tank based in Washington, D.C., that played a large role in creating Project 2025. Carlson is a close friend to the Heritage Foundation, and there were calls for the Heritage Foundation basically to chastise Tucker Carlson for having platformed Nick Fuentes.
And they did the opposite, at least initially.
Yes. The head of the Heritage Foundation, Kevin Roberts, declined to do that. He posted a video on X where he said they wouldn't capitulate to pressure from the, quote, globalist class to cancel people on the right. Globalists, this is a well-known dog whistle among anti-Semitic conspiracists. So his refusal to sort of distance the Heritage Foundation from this created this uproar on the right. And so several people working at the Heritage Foundation, particularly on their effort to fight anti-Semitism, left the organization. But there was also like a wider controversy just within the Republican Party, where current and former senators basically were like, it's time to draw the line and disavow the, quote, Hitler is cool.
Yeah, I'll just name drop a few of them. Senator Ted Cruz, Senator Mitch McConnell. We also heard from conservative podcaster Ben Shapiro. There are plenty of conservatives out there.
Senator Lindsey Graham.
Right, condemning the Fuentes appearance. But I there's a bigger context. This interview did not happen in isolation. And I'm thinking of some other racist rhetoric coming from parts of the political right. Just a couple of weeks ago, Politico published this excerpts from a group chat. This was leaders of young Republican groups.
Yeah, that's right. So private chats that were happening among leaders of young Republicans in four states, where they were saying things like, I love Hitler, and
joking about sending political opponents to the gas chamber and so on. I do need to note NPR has not independently verified those texts. We're citing Politico reporting here, which did not stop Vice President J.D. Vance from leaping into the fray. This is him talking about pearl clutching in an episode of The Charlie Kirk Show.
And I really don't want us to grow up in a country where a kid telling a stupid joke, telling a very offensive stupid joke, is cause to ruin their lives.
I don't want to grow up in that kind of country either, but I will note that the people in this alleged chat were all adults, right, Odette?
Yeah, I mean, young Republicans goes up to the age of 40, and some of them held elected positions. These weren't people that were still in college necessarily.
NPR's Odette Youssef on our national security podcast, Sources and Methods. You can hear it wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
It is 18 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. Coming up next is your daily dose of phonology, where John Latimer looks back at his nature notes from the state. Local businesses, you can help defend the future of KAXE and keep people-powered radio on the air with your sponsorship dollars. Visit kaxe.org/give to learn about sponsorship options. A big thank you to all our current business sponsors. Now it's time for your daily dose of phonology.
On today's date, November 6th, 1999, I'm saddened to discover that the eagle's nest has fallen to the ground. The white pine that supported it had been scarred by a porcupine's, and the top had died. And finally, the nest fell. It was built in 1985, and it lasted until this November 1999. I was dismayed because I saw this as the end of a chance to have an eagle as a neighbor, but I was mistaken because just 1 week later, on the 12th of November, I noticed that they are beginning anew to build a nest in an aspen, which is not far removed from the tree that they had the nest in previously. Having eagles for neighbors is a unique and exciting experience because when they fledge, when the young fledge from the nest, oftentimes they end up in some unpredictable places, like on my deck rail or in my yard or on a branch in a tree right near my door. All exciting spots.
So
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from Chapter, offering Medicare advice to seniors nationwide this enrollment period and working to find the plans that best fit their needs. Advisors are available by dialing #250 and saying the keyword Medicare Help.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The government shutdown is about to have a big impact on air travel. The Federal Aviation Administration is moving to reduce air traffic by 10% at dozens of major airports starting tomorrow. FAA Administrator Brian Bedford says these cuts are necessary to keep the airspace safe as the agency deals with a shortage of air traffic controllers.
When we see pressures building in these 40 markets, we just can't ignore it, you know, and we're not going to wait for a safety problem to truly manifest itself when the early indicators are telling us we can take action today to prevent, you know, things from deteriorating.
But there are a lot of questions about this planned reduction in air traffic, including what it will mean for airlines and air travelers. NPR transportation correspondent Joel Rose has been trying to find us some answers. Hey, Joel.
Hey, Mary Louise.
Start with the basics. Just exactly how are they thinking this is going to work?
Yeah, the airlines have received a preliminary list of 40 major airports from the FAA that will be affected by these reductions, including some major hubs, Atlanta, Chicago, Denver, Dallas, Houston, Newark, New Jersey. The airlines say they will be phasing these cancellations in gradually. For example, United says it will be cutting 4% of flights tomorrow, gradually working up to 10% by next week. The airlines are saying this will not affect international flights, only domestic, which is good news for the big airlines because those international flights account for a big chunk of their profits.
And what kind of news is it for those of us who are about to board planes? I'm raising my hand. I'm flying this weekend. I hope.
Well, it's hard to say. Delta Airlines said today it would operate the vast majority of its flights as scheduled. United says this is not a high demand time of year to fly, so the airline does have empty seats, and it's optimistic that it can accommodate most ticket holders. But travelers like you are understandably worried. Our member station WABE spoke to a woman named Ellen Silva, who had just arrived in Atlanta today on Southwest Airlines. Silva is supposed to fly back to Baltimore on Tuesday, and she is concerned about what could happen if that flight is canceled.
I would miss work, and I'd have some very unhappy people that I work for because they depend on me so they can travel. And if I'm not there, they can't leave.
Yeah. I want to say thank you to all of the TSA workers who are on the job despite not having gotten a paycheck for a while now, which prompts the question, why is this happening right now?
Well, the official explanation from the FAA, as we heard at the top, is that it's necessary for safety. The government shutdown is clearly taking a toll on air traffic controllers who are required to work without pay.
Yeah.
Some of them have taken on second jobs. Many are calling out sick. And overall, the air traffic control system had been working fairly well during the shutdown until this past weekend when we did see some staffing shortages at dozens of facilities around the same time. And Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy said yesterday the decision to reduce air traffic was based on data.
This was not taken lightly. We will drive these decisions based on the data that we receive and make the best calls that we can to keep those who travel through the airspace safe.
Duffy was asked exactly what data administrators were looking at and did not say. There's a lot of speculation online, including from some air traffic controllers, that this is mainly a PR move or a political move that's related to negotiations to end the government shutdown.
Mm-hmm.
It's also possible that more than one of these explanations could be true at the same time. In other words, it could be about safety or politics or both.
Bottom line, for those of us hoping to fly in the next few days, where do you put the chances of complete chaos?
Well, a spokesman for United told NPR today this is not all that different from what airlines do during the summer to adjust for a major thunderstorm. But this is bigger than just a thunderstorm in one part of the country. This is 40 airports all at once. So it's hard to predict.
No real precedent for something at this scale. NPR's Joel Rose, thanks.
You're welcome.
This afternoon, a federal judge in Rhode Island ordered the Trump administration to pay full SNAP food benefits to people and to do so by tomorrow. It is not immediately clear how that could happen, but the judge criticized the government for not considering the consequences of not funding the country's biggest anti-hunger program. NPR's Jennifer Ludden has been covering this and is here now. Hi.
Hi.
Jennifer, this is a huge change from the last ruling, which was nearly a week ago, and you've been following all of these twists and turns. And as you've reported, the administration was planning partial SNAP payments. What happened today?
Well, a group of cities and nonprofits that had sued over Trump cutting off SNAP were not pleased with this idea of partial payments for November. Recall the administration had been planning to cut benefits by 50%. Actually, just last night, it recalculated and sent out new guidance saying it was lowering that to a 35% cut, although many people would have seen much deeper cuts than that. But the plaintiffs in this lawsuit said partial payments are not enough. They argued officials were not moving fast enough. And, you know, we've already heard states say it could take them weeks to get out payments. So this group went back to court asking for full SNAP benefits. And Judge John McConnell Jr. agreed in an oral ruling from the bench.
And to be clear, this judge had signed off on partial payments. So what did he have to say about why he was changing his order?
A key point for the judge was a Truth Social post by President Trump 2 days ago. In it, Trump said SNAP benefits, quote, will be given only when the radical left Democrats open up government, which they can easily do and not before. Now, shortly after that, White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt went, no. She told reporters the administration was continuing to work on making partial payments happen. But speaking from the bench this afternoon, Judge McConnell said that post showed intent to defy a court order. McConnell also said the government failed to consider the practical consequences when it chose to only partially fund SNAP. He said it was clear they knew there could be long delays, and those delays, he said, are harmful to the people who rely on these benefits.
Jennifer, getting full benefits out by tomorrow seems incredibly challenging. Any sense of how that's expected to happen?
Not so clear just yet. One thing to remember, though, there is other money from customs revenues that the Trump administration could use to make full SNAP payments. This judge and another judge in Boston in a separate lawsuit had both said that that would be legal. It was Trump administration officials who questioned that legality, and they also said they wanted to keep that money for other uses like child nutrition programs. But that could be where they turn now. And just a reminder that, you know, none of this has ever been considered before because this is so unprecedented. This is a 60-year-old program, and money for SNAP benefits has never lapsed again, ever.
And this raises some questions for states too, right? I mean, they administer SNAP, and they were supposed to be working on getting partial payments out, and now there's been this big switch.
Sure. Absolutely. They've been working really hard. I have no doubt some will be happy if this really does go ahead. We've heard from several states that the partial payment formula is very complicated. It's labor intensive. It could take states weeks to get money to people. You know, and policy analysts say, look, the easier and faster thing to do is to just do what's already set up for the system, which is regular full payments.
It's early still, but I'm wondering if you're hearing any reaction to this decision.
A couple from people who were part of lawsuits. Letitia James, Attorney General of New York, states it sued. She says it's outrageous it took a lawsuit to make the government feed its own people. And the National Council of Nonprofits, in a statement, Diane Yentel said, talked about nonprofit food banks and food pantries just doing everything they can to try and fill this gap and the unsustainable strain this has put on that sector.
NPR's Jennifer Ludden, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Democrats scored decisive victories for the party up and down the ballot this week.
I think we've stopped the bleeding. But under no circumstances is the Democratic brand, quote unquote, fixed, or is it back?
How are Democrats charting a path forward? That's tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It is 4:29, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is National Native News. Programming on KXE KBXE is supported in part by the Minnesota Humanities Center, distributing more than $6 million in cultural heritage grants. Funds are available to individuals and organizations that will create, celebrate, and teach the art, culture, and heritage of the state's diverse culture. That includes, but is not limited to, indigenous organizations, historically underrepresented communities, recent immigrant communities, and veterans. Application and deadline information is online at mnhum.org/grants. And we receive support from L&M Fleet Supply, carrying a variety of products for your next outdoor adventure with 13 locations across the Northland or at lmsupply.com. Now it's time for National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Some tribal leaders are supporting a proposed bill that could expand sports betting in Wisconsin. Chuck Kornbach has more.
About three dozen states allow some form of sports betting, but in Wisconsin, the only legal way to place a wager on a sporting event is at some tribal casinos. Proposed legislation would allow Wisconsin tribes to operate computer servers and other technology so that sports gamblers could be anywhere in the state and place a bet online. Jeff Crawford is Attorney General of the Forest County Potawatomi. He told a legislative hearing that allowing tribes to offer more sports betting would encourage gamblers to turn away from using illegal and unreliable offshore betting firms.
While online gaming is currently at the Wild West in Wisconsin with no regulations or protections for consumers, it does not have to be.
Kyle White Eagle is a tribal legislator for the Ho-Chunk Nation. He says his tribe provides a lot of services across a wide geographic area and needs additional gaming revenue to better tackle problems like poverty and opioid addiction.
Giving tribes in Wisconsin the right to conduct mobile sports betting isn't going to solve these problems completely, but it will help significantly and it will be funding well spent.
But a coalition of national commercial sports gambling firms, including DraftKings and FanDuel, opposes the Wisconsin bill. Attorney Damon Stewart of the Sports Betting Alliance says gamblers would lose out if legally they could only go through the tribes.
Unfortunately, this bill will not result in a competitive market for online sports betting that provides consumers with choice.
If the mobile sports betting bill passes in Wisconsin, it would still take time for the state to renegotiate gaming compacts with the tribes and for the U.S. Interior Department to approve the gaming expansion. For National Native News, I'm Chuck Kornbach.
An Arizona tribe is giving its members some financial relief as the federal government shutdown continues, impacting programs like food assistance. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports.
The Gila River Indian community is calling them general welfare payments, one-time $1,000 disbursements for each 18-year-old tribal member, regardless of whether they're a SNAP recipient. That decision came on Saturday during a special counsel session called by Governor Stephen Roe Lewis.
I hope that this payment brings some peace of mind during this time of uncertainty at the federal level.
Lewis urges his tribe south of Phoenix to plan for the long haul.
So please, use or set aside for your food needs to pay bills and to add some measure of economic security.
For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
The chairman of the Lumbee Tribe of North Carolina says he's confident that this year full services and benefits will be extended to his tribe. Chairman John Lowry made the remarks Wednesday during a legislative hearing on the Lumbee Fairness Act, which would grant the tribe federal recognition. Lowry says his tribe has long sought federal status.
I'm a descendant of Solomon Locklear Sr., one of the 44 tribal leaders who in 1888, petitioned Congress to recognize the Lumbee tribe. Today, 137 years later, I stand before you once again advocating for justice and equal treatment through full federal recognition.
Wednesday's hearing in the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs included opposition. Leaders from the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians of North Carolina and the Shawnee Tribe of Oklahoma testified against the bill, while Lowry submitted a list of tribal support and testified that nearly all of North Carolina's congressional delegation backs the bill. President Trump, in a statement this week, issued his support for the Lumbee Tribe. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by AARP, whose Family Caregiver Resource Guide is available to caregivers by calling 877-333-5885 or at aarp.org/caregiver resources.
Kaufman & Associates is a Native-owned and led consulting firm, supporting Native communities with culturally grounded solutions to shape Indigenous futures. More at kaufmaninc.com, KAUFFMANINC.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Today, the Supreme Court allowed President Trump to proceed with his plan to require that passport applicants list their sex as designated on their birth certificate without any accommodation for transgender individuals. The court's decision overturns, at least for now, a lower court decision that had blocked the Trump passport policy from going into effect. The vote was 6-3 along ideological lines. Joining me now, NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg. Hey, Nina.
Hi there.
Start with what the Trump policy is. How does it differ from previous policy?
Well, for 33 years across six presidential administrations, the State Department has allowed transgender people to list their gender identity on passport applications instead of their sex listed at birth. But the Trump administration broke with those policies, putting in place a requirement that everyone getting a passport list their gender as their sex at birth. A group of transgender individuals brought a class action challenging the policy and contending that it amounted to unconstitutional sex discrimination. And they won in the lower courts. The Trump administration then went to the Supreme Court asking that those lower court orders be blocked, at least for now, and the court gave the administration what it wanted.
And I gather, Nina, this is another of these cases that have been brought to the court on the emergency docket. A lot of those cases have been criticized because the court has failed to explain its reasoning. Was today's court order any different?
You know, I think so. While the explanation was only about a page and a half long, it was unusually blunt. And here let me quote from what the court said. Displaying passport holders' sex at birth no more offends equal protection principles than does the requirement that the passport show the person's country at birth. In both cases, the justices said, the government is merely attesting to a historical fact without subjecting anyone to different treatment.
Although there have been allegations that some of the plaintiffs who joined this case, that they had been beaten up, they had been subjected to strip searches once it became clear that they were transgender?
Yes, that is true. But the court didn't give much weight to those claims, and therefore the unsigned opinion said that the government was likely to prevail when and if the case comes back to the court after the Court of Appeals, which had refused to intervene, reviews the trial court decision. In fact, the Supreme Court said it was the Trump administration that was suffering from an irreparable injury by not being able to carry out a policy with foreign affairs implications.
We said this was a 6-3 decision. Are the three dissenters the ones who I'm imagining they were?
Yes, they are. Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson wrote for the three liberal justices. She accused the majority of allowing a questionable policy to be adopted without any justification, while at the same time blinding itself to the actual demonstrations of harm to individuals who brought this case. Mm-hmm. As Jackson put it in her sizzling dissent, the court has once again paved the way for immediate infliction of injury without adequate or really any justification. Because I cannot acquiesce to this pointless but painful perversion of our equitable discretion, I respectfully dissent.
Thank you, Nina.
Thank you.
And NPR's Nina Totenberg.
The movie Christie, which opens Friday, is based on the true story of Christie Martin, once considered the most exciting and successful female boxer. In the 1990s, she won titles and was inducted into the International Boxing Hall of Fame. She was the first woman signed by boxing promoter Don King.
Jesse here says that you fight in all pink.
I'm from West Virginia.
What's that got to do with pink?
Nothing, sir. I'm just telling you about myself.
Actress Sydney Sweeney portrays Martin, who also survived violence outside the boxing ring, NPR's Mandalay Del Barco reports.
We meet up with the real Christy Salters Martin at Oscar de la Hoya's Golden Boy Gym in downtown L.A. For a photo shoot, she slips on a pair of boxing gloves to punch a speed bag. After recording a quick TikTok message for her fans, she sits down for an interview wearing her signature pink.
Champ, champ, sit.
Her tiny Pomeranian Champ is nestled on her lap, quietly sucking on her finger.
He's a baby. It keeps both he and I calm.
At 57, Martin reminisces about her boxing career.
My style was definitely seek and destroy. Knocking somebody out and trash talking. It was fun.
Martin says she grew up in West Virginia playing Little League baseball and basketball on boys' teams. There were no girls' teams yet. In college on a basketball scholarship, she suggested to a local promoter that women should also fight in the amateur tough man contests.
I thought it would be fun, and I had no idea what I was doing, but neither did anyone else. I was an athlete. They were just barroom brawlers, just tough women. I probably wouldn't want to run into them on the street. But in the ring where there's rules, I was okay.
She married her trainer and manager, Jim Martin, who was 25 years older. Barely 5'5", she punched above her weight and kept winning fights. That's when promoter Don King came calling.
Here I am, a coal miner's daughter from this little bitty town in southern West Virginia. I'm sitting across the table from Don King and, wow, feel out of place. But he gave me a wonderful opportunity.
Martin says inside the boxing ring, she felt safe. But her private life was a different story. For 2 decades, she suffered her husband's emotional and physical brutality.
People probably thought I was on top of the world. I was fighting on the biggest cards being promoted, fighting in Las Vegas, fighting in Madison Square Garden, cover Sports Illustrated. I mean, I was doing a lot of really cool things. But at home, I was being reminded about, you know, if ever you leave me, I'll kill you.
The film Christy depicts how Jim Martin tried to make good on 2 decades of threats and how Christy survived being stabbed and shot by him in 2010. Australian director David Michaud wrote the script with his partner, Mira Folks.
I really liked the idea of making a film about a kind of trash-talking, colorful woman. But more importantly, I was drawn to the idea of, like, how is it that a woman as tough as Christy can be trapped in a relationship like this for 20 years.
In her 2022 memoir, Fighting for Survival, Martin wrote about enduring sexual abuse as a child and domestic abuse as an adult and having to hide her sexuality. She now runs a nonprofit for survivors, Christy's Champs, and in speeches, she encourages others to leave abusive situations.
When you talk to somebody about the struggle, when you talk to somebody about the escape, you start to feel like you can do it.
Martin says her ex-husband died in prison last year. She married her former rival, Lisa Hollowine, and lately she's been having fun promoting the film with the actress who portrays her, Sydney Sweeney.
I mean, Christy is a trailblazer. She's the ultimate underdog, an incredible role model, advocate.
Sweeney says she trained for 2.5 months in a boxing gym she built in her grandmother's shed. She also pounded protein shakes to bulk up another 35 pounds. The actress also produced the film through her company, 50/50 Films.
I mean, I was surprised every day by the different battles that Christy fought within the ring, outside the ring, but not allowing all the pain to define who she is. She's actually getting to save lives every day.
Christy Martin says Sydney Sweeney really nailed her boxing style and her antics, including sticking her tongue out at opponents. Mandalay Del Barco, NPR News, Los Angeles.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
You're listening to All Things Considered here on this Thursday afternoon here on KAXE KBXE. Coming up next is North Star Stories. Support comes from Paul Bunyan Communications, powered by the GigaZone, offering fiber optic fast internet speeds up to 10 gig and GigaZone Wi-Fi to support devices wirelessly. Paul Bunyan Communications, Northern Minnesota's local broadband cooperative. Do you love music and are interested in becoming an on-air volunteer DJ at KAXE KBXE? On-air volunteers are the lifeblood of our station, and our fall training is coming up Wednesday, November 12th at KAXE, or in Bemidji at KBXE, Thursday, November 13th. Both classes run 5:30 to 7 p.m. Email volunteer at kaxe.org for more info or to confirm attendance. And listen Saturdays at 2 p.m. and Sundays at 3 p.m. for She Rose Radio, amplifying female voices in music with Carmel Holt. Now it's time for North Star Stories.
You are listening to North Star Stories, voices from where we live, a daily newscast about what it means to live in Minnesota.
In today's broadcast, a proposed natural cemetery sparks controversy. Then, how some organizations are using food as medicine. And a new scam targets consumers' mobile wallets. I'm Chantel Sings. A proposed natural cemetery in eastern Minnesota is at the center of a federal court case. Several news outlets report the 20-acre site in Black Hoof Township, owned by a New Jersey nonprofit, would become Loving Earth Memorial Gardens, a 512-plot natural cemetery. In this newly approved practice, the body is placed in a biodegradable material to decompose fully and return to nature. But neighbors worry about soil and water safety. A judge is expected to rule on the case in the next few months. Next, food insecure households are at least 2 to 3 times more likely to suffer heart disease, diabetes, and high blood pressure. Britt Ahmet speaks with Minnesota organizations that are providing food for hunger and health.
The idea of food as medicine has been with humanity for thousands of years and has been shared across cultures. But nearly a million people, about 1 in 10 individuals in Minnesota, don't have enough food. This is according to data provided by Second Harvest Heartland. And the state's largest hunger relief organization noticed something else too after a survey of its clients.
People who are food insecure are much more likely to face chronic disease.
Robin Manthe is the director of Second Harvest Neighbor Services. She says the reasons why food insecure folks are more prone to chronic illness are multifaceted.
Inconsistent access to food and nutritious food, the stress of that, the quality of the nutrition you're getting, those are all contributing to these challenging chronic health diseases.
Put another way, people who don't have enough to eat are often facing other stressors like inconsistent housing and transportation. They may live in a food desert without a proper grocery store where the cheapest and most available meals are the junk foods we're supposed to avoid. Robin says this can impact long-term health.
If you are food insecure, you are 2 to 3 times more likely to face diabetes. You're 6 times more likely to have heart disease, and you're 2 times more likely to have high blood pressure.
For almost a decade, the Second Harvest program, FoodRx, has helped Minnesotans who are both food insecure and already dealing with at least one chronic disease.
We are really excited that in Minnesota, some of our health systems, as well as some of our Medicaid insurers, understand this connection of food as medicine. They partner with us to identify patients that they serve who are food insecure and have chronic disease, and then are able to basically prescribe them this medically tailored food box.
So in addition to prescribing insulin or high blood pressure pills, the doctor of a food insecure patient can also prescribe a monthly box of food curated for that individual's health needs. FoodRx also comes with food education and nutrition coaching. Combining nutrition with conventional medicine is also a win for healthcare providers.
We know, based on Fairview's own data, that patients experiencing food insecurity are nearly twice as likely to be readmitted to the hospital.
Kate Henschel is a coordinator with Fairview Health Services Food as Medicine program, Fair Table.
Food as medicine is really just thinking about making sure that all people have the food that they need to thrive.
You can find out more about FoodRx at 2harvest.org. This is Britt Ahmet for North Star Stories.
You are listening to North Star Stories. Watch your wallet. Scammers are using a tactic called ghost tapping to charge tap-to-pay cards and mobile wallets without contact. Fraudsters may crowd you, pose as vendors, or rush donations to slip through small charges that add up. To protect yourself, monitor card statements, enable transaction alerts, shield your card or phone with RFID protection, and ask for receipts before you tap.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. A jury in Washington, D.C. has acquitted a man who threw a sandwich at a federal officer. The episode went viral, and it came to symbolize how parts of this city responded to an increased federal law enforcement presence. NPR's Carrie Johnson reports.
Sean Charles Dunn hugged his lawyers as the jury foreman read the verdict, not guilty. The jury rejected a misdemeanor assault charge against Dunn for throwing a foot-long sub sandwich at a Customs and Border Protection agent in August. Dunn says he feels relieved and is looking forward to moving on with his life.
And I am so happy that justice prevails.
Dunn's an Air Force veteran who worked at the Justice Department. Attorney General Pam Bondi fired him after a video of the sandwich incident went viral. On the video, Dunn called officers patrolling the city as part of President Trump's Safe and Beautiful D.C. order fascists and racists. Dunn thought they were about to do an immigration raid at a gay nightclub on Latin night.
Every life matters, no matter where you came from, no matter how you got here, no matter how you identify.
Prosecutors initially tried to charge Dunn with a felony, but a grand jury refused to indict him. Instead, DOJ pursued a less serious misdemeanor count, arguing that Dunn had forcibly assaulted, resisted, or impeded the federal agent. Prosecutors say Dunn went too far, that you can't just throw things, especially at law enforcement. Agent Gregory Lairmore testified the sandwich exploded on his bulletproof vest. He said mustard got on his uniform and onion on his radio. Defense lawyers showed a photo of the hero, still mostly in its wrapper, on the street. Sabrina Schroff told the jury to use its common sense. This was not a weapon hurled with force anywhere near justifying federal charges. Outside the courthouse, Schroff beamed at the crowd.
We really want to thank the jury for having sent back an affirmation that dissent is what is not just tolerated. It is legal, it is welcome, and we thank them all very much for that verdict here.
Images of Dunn throwing the sandwich now adorn banners and T-shirts. His pink shirt may have been noticed by the jury. This week, two jurors wore bright pink sweaters. Another looked at the defense table and pumped her fists before she filed out of the courtroom following the verdict. Carrie Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
Do you remember who won the Grammy Award for Best Country Album this year?
This ain't Texas. Woo! Ain't no hold'em.
Hey! So yeah, there's your clue. It was Beyoncé, Cowboy Carter. Next year, though, there won't be a Best Country Album winner. That is because the Grammys are splitting the category in two, Best Contemporary and Best Traditional Country Album. Julie Height of Nashville Public Radio says the change is a result of a years-long effort to support artists who have been overshadowed by their chart-topping peers.
In certain country music circles, the announcement about the new Grammy categories was big news.
I got about 7,000 text messages within 10 minutes. I'm not joking, like I thought someone was dead.
That's Sunny Sweeney, a modern honky-tonk artist. She's worked the bar circuit for more than two decades, delivering rowdy, emotionally incisive drinking and divorce songs in a vinegary twang. Fans and fellow artists blew up her phone because they thought the Grammy changes could mean she'd finally get some industry recognition. To her, that hadn't seemed possible since her brief stint on a Music Row label ended over a decade ago.
I did put out a record that I was very proud of, but then I got dropped because I was too country for country.
Sweeney hasn't been alone in sensing mainstream indifference towards sensibilities like hers.
For years, a lot of the traditional country community felt disenfranchised. And not just from the Grammys, but really from all of sort of commercial country.
That's Kyle Koronis, creator of the website Saving Country Music. There's a precedent for the Grammys dividing genres whose competing impulses don't fit neatly into one category. That's happened with jazz, blues, and R&B, points out Harvey Mason Jr. He's the CEO of the Recording Academy, which runs the Grammys, and he says they don't make changes lightly.
So I don't sit there and decide, I think we should do this, or I think we should call it that. We hear from the community of people that make those genres of music. They give us their recommendations, they draft proposals, and those proposals go into the trustee room for a vote.
Koronis has been campaigning online for a traditional category since 2019. He teamed up with Grammy staffers to research how many albums could go in a traditional category if one existed. And once the Grammys made the change, Koronis worked to ensure submissions came in.
I'll tell you this, it has been beyond rewarding to reach out to independent country artists that don't have managers and labels and to say, hey, I think that your album is good enough to submit to the Grammys. Do you want some help with that?
Not all tradition-leaning artists needed that sort of advocacy.
But I'm somewhere outside of Missoula. They just called my name from the stage.
That easeful, elastic singer is a 28-year-old mainstream hitmaker. His name? Zach Top. He's winning Nashville over with his classic sensibilities. Katie Dean, who runs Top's label, couldn't be more pleased that his sound now has a devoted Grammy lane.
Zach's name was the first one that came to mind. I mean, just sort of across the board, we heard it. There's not a whole lot of current country artists who are taking fiddle and steel out on the road. I think it's really gratifying to see that the kind of music he's making is resonating in such a mainstream way.
In Top's case, Dean says her team had the luxury of choosing between traditional and contemporary categories. But Charlie Crockett considers even the Grammys' expanded options an uncomfortable fit. He built his audience through tireless touring and self-funded recordings of cowboy ballads and working-class blues, and he distrusts the industry and its awards.
I don't like playing those games because how are you going to classify it? If you're going to call me country, why would it automatically be traditional country? Am I not as contemporary country as anybody in the field?
He remembers the thrill of being a winner in the days of his first rodeo.
Crockett was up for a Grammy in 2024 for Best Americana Album. That's where plenty of artists with rootsy reference points landed in years past. But Crockett finds it disorienting to be viewed as any sort of genre figurehead. When we spoke, he was wrestling with whether to submit either of his eligible albums to the Grammys. The first five traditional country album nominees will be announced tomorrow. And Sonny Sweeney says that in itself is a win, even if her album Rhinestone Requiem isn't among them.
I have been fighting for 20 years musically to feel recognized. And I mean people like myself, not just, oh, I want to be recognized. I just want my type of country music to be recognized.
For NPR News, I'm Julie Height in Nashville.
I rode my old Gibson Dove right out.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Procter & Gamble, maker of ZQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZQuil.com. From the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation, collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. We receive support from North Homes Children and Family Services, providing mental health care in Minnesota. November is National Adoption Awareness Month, highlighting the need for adoptive and foster care families. North Homes provides licensing and case management for those opening their heart and home. More information is available at northhomes.org. Minnesota Mixtape is our deep dive into the local music scene, Fridays at 10 a.m. and Saturdays at 3 p.m. with host Malachi Coons. Looking at weather tonight, cloudy skies with a slight chance of rain, lows 29 to 35 degrees, southeast winds 5 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy with highs 35 to 38, northwest winds 10 to 20, temperatures falling in the evening to 16 to 23.